from my sister this afternoon, and my youngest nephew, Corwin, was baptized today. So that's great. So it's really, really excellent. Really love my nieces and nephews so much. They're so fantastic. It was so wonderful to spend a week with them and the whole family up in Tahoe. It's just really nice to see them growing up and becoming the types of people that you wish that kids would become. And it's just, I'm proud of them. I like talking to them. I like being with them. It's just so joyous. I've struggled with how to start this lesson. I'd like to say just a few extra words before I do. Tim's gone to get his things in Kansas, the rest of his stuff anyway. And so he's out, as Justin mentioned this morning, for a couple of weeks. And so we're doing a series. There's some challenge to that, which is kind of fun. It's fun to have some challenges. It's a different situation doing sermons in tandem with somebody. Even if you do some coordination, you always wonder, how much will I be saying that's like the other person? How much will I be saying that's not? How much will I bore the audience because I'm in the same zone? And it's an interesting dynamic. I like it. I have to admit, I didn't tell Justin this. He might have thought the same thing. He suggested it very graciously. And when he said that, the first thing that popped into my head was one of those like 80s cop movies where the crusty old cop comes in and they're like, you got a new partner. I don't need a partner. I work alone. And so there was a part of me that was sort of thought that, but only it was a flash. It was very short. And then I thought, this is going to be fun. And I was very happy to have this opportunity because someone said something at Tahoe Family Encampment during a lesson that I found profound. And so that's our basis for our series. And the speaker, Ralph Gilmore, was talking about prayers and the answers to prayers. And he said that, you know, four of the great men in the Bible pray and get answered no. You know, there's, of course, the most well-known one is Jesus. And Justin talked about Moses this morning. And then you have Paul with his, I prayed three times that the thorn would leave my side, and God said no. And now tonight, we're going to talk about a fourth one. The passage we're going to start in is so familiar to you, and you maybe already know it. I've struggled with myself how to get you there without immediately having your mind go down the same path it always does. There's some challenges here when it comes to preaching very well-trod parts of Scripture. Surely we can get new lessons from them, but I try to imagine, how do I get you there in a way where you don't just immediately think the same lessons are forthcoming and maybe go with me to some place I wish you were? Does this make sense? So I want to start with boredom. You know, when I was a kid, I would sometimes say I was bored. And my mother would say, well, you know what she'd say. Usually I would end up in the yard weeding. This made no sense to me. It made no sense at all because while I was weeding, I was still bored. You know, it wasn't really a cure for boredom. I had nothing to think about except pull these things out. I thought, this is not a cure for boredom. I'm still bored. I may be weeding now, but I'm still bored. Boredom is not cured by weeding. Boredom is not cured by having something necessarily to do with your hands. To say you're bored doesn't mean that you are physically have nothing to do. It means that you mentally have nothing to do. Imagine, if you will, and as a child, you probably might have done this, that you can get to a point in your life where you're not bored anymore, right? You thought to yourself, well, maybe I can reach a point where I'm not bored anymore. And yet we still struggle with that, don't we? Even as adults, even in this world, it's almost like the more avenues of entertainment there are, the more bored we are. It's like the famous song, which now seems so, okay, it's a product of its era. The song was, I think, 57 channels and nothing on. Now 57 seems really, really small today, doesn't it? Right? There's thousands of channels and nothing on. And so, but you imagine to yourself, well, what if you were a king? Maybe you could deal with your boredom that way. Maybe you could find something that would not make you bored. But I still think that if you were king, you still might be bored, and you might find yourself walking around your palace, army's gone, they left you all alone, you got nothing to do, you wander onto the roof, you look around the city, hopefully all of you know which passage we're already in, and she's down there bathing. She's down there bathing. You look down there and ask your advisors, who's that over there? Who's that lady that lives in this area over there? Maybe your advisors, sorry, where? Over, you mean on Downs and Ward? No, I'm speaking another block over to the left, you know, up there. Oh, that, I think that's Uriah's wife. Yeah, one of your mighty men. Yeah, he's off. Can you get her for me? Bring her over? Well, who's an advisor to the king that say no, right? Bring her over, take care of the boredom problem. Unfortunately, she sends you a note a little bit later, right? I'm pregnant. Well, what are you gonna do now? How about you call the guy back from the front? How about you call Uriah back and you set it up so that nobody knows what happened? Basically, call him back, he's gonna be, you know, look, let's all be honest here. You go far away from your wife, who's beautiful, for, you know, months. I mean, this was not like a week-long government trip they were on. This was a long time, okay? And so you call him back from the front. Hey, send me Uriah, Joab. Send me Uriah. Bring him back here. So back comes Uriah. And Uriah is this, he's kind of like a Mary Sue in this whole chapter. He is always doing the right thing. And he's a Hittite. He's not even a person of Israel, isn't he? So, but in this passage, he comes back and David says, oh, I'm glad you're back. You're doing a great job, Uriah. Maybe he gets an award for good service, something to put up on his wall. And then David figures, good to go. Problem solved. I love how in this story there's implications everywhere. Nothing's directly stated, but there's just sort of a shared knowledge that this is how the machinery of life works. And yet the next day, David wakes up and there's Uriah. He's hanging out with all the servants from the palace. He hasn't even gone home at all. Maybe his wife doesn't even know he's home. Right? He's not even in town. He's in town. He lays out front. David says, what are you doing? He says, I can't go home when everybody else is out in the field, when everybody else is there. And of course, I've heard it preached before, entire lesson on the fact that this is a little bit of an indictment to David. You're here too, king, even though you were one of the great warriors of Israel's past, you know, the killer of the giant, he who slays his 10,000s, and yet you're here by yourself. You're hanging out and you're put in your Cush palace. And so the rest of the army's not. The rest of the army's in the field. Well, I can't do that. I'm an army guy, so I'm going to sleep out here in the front. I'm not going to act like I'm crazy. I'm not going to go home. There's a reason why Uriah is one of the great warriors. And so David says, no problem. I know how to work this. A little alcohol will take care of this problem. So he brings him back, and literally in the passage it says, he wines and dines him, and he gets him drunk. The passage says he gets him drunk. He successfully gets Uriah drunk. But Uriah is the type of guy who can get drunk and still not go home to his wife. So he goes out and still sleeps the next night. He sleeps the next night in the front. David comes back again. Guy still hasn't gone home. David's just trying to get rid of this whole thing. He's doing everything wrong in this passage. And of course he doubles down, doesn't he? Because now he panics. And he says, hey Uriah, I'm going to send you back to the front. It's where he wants to be anyway, right? Uriah doesn't want to be there. Uriah wants to be out where the army's at. So he writes him a note and says, hey, Joab, can you put this guy with the fighting strongest and make sure he dies? And then he gives him the note. He knows Uriah is so faithful, so trustworthy that Uriah won't even break that seal. He won't even breathe on it. He won't even try some Hollywood trick and open it up. Nope, Uriah doesn't even do it. Doesn't read the letter at all, goes back to the front with it. And of course, Joab says, yeah, no problem. Takes care of the matter, sends him back a messenger, says, deed is done. And David says, okay, no problem. Brings Bathsheba in, figures everything's tied up in a nice little bow. And it would have been too if it weren't for those, what, all-seeing God, right? If it weren't for the fact that you're dealing with a being who's omniscient at this point in the story, who's going to know? Nobody's going to get on you. Your advisors don't care what you do. They went and got her for you anyway. They're not going to go tell people that you're wrong. He's an ancient Semitic king. He gets to do whatever he wants to. And the only person in the story who's upset about it at this point is God. And so now we have the famous passage where, and we're in, everybody knows where we're at, 2 Samuel 11 and bleeding over into 12. And Nathan the prophet comes. And Nathan the prophet comes to David. And this is the same Nathan, by the way, who has been dealing with David. He's like, you can almost consider him David's personal prophet. And they have a great relationship because David is a godly king. That's the most important thing to understand prior to this story, is that David's a fantastic king. He's so good a king that when his personal prophet, that when Nathan is talking to him and they chat and hang out, that's how great a king he is. And the prophet doesn't have much problem with David. He's so good a king that when Nathan comes to him and says, and David says, you know, I got a good idea, Nathan. Nate's like, what's that? And he says, thinking about building a house for God. Thinking about building a temple, big house for God. Seems wrong that I'm living in this big house and that God doesn't have a house. And Nathan doesn't even go ask God because it's David. He just says, man, go do what you want to do. Take care of it. And he leaves. And God says, whoa, I don't want him to do that. Go back and tell him I don't want him to do that. Right? So, but you'll notice that Nathan, out the gate, because David is such a great king, such a godly king, and this sounds like such a perfect idea, Nathan doesn't even go ask. He just says, yeah, sure, that's probably fine. You know, it's probably fine. And so this is the kind of king that David is before this. Now, Nathan knows he's got to go talk to David. You've got to go tell a king that he's done something wrong. This is not going to be a good moment for Nathan. And Nathan goes to him with one of the most famous parables in the whole Bible, right? Where he talks about he really gets the hairs on David's back of his neck up. He makes him angry. And the famous, very famous line after David gets really irate about this unjust story of the rich man and the poor man, and the poor man's only got one little ewe and his family loves it. It's his pet ewe. I don't even think they're going to eat it. They just use it for some milk and it's a family pet. And the rich guy's got a whole herd. And so when somebody comes over, the rich guy entertains the family with the poor guy's ewe. And David, he's just mad about this, which you can see. Why? Because it's a story that makes all of us mad. And David's like, that guy, he's got to pay with it with his life. This is bad. And Nathan says a very famous line. He says, you are the man. And it's very, at that moment, it's almost Hollywood courtroom style is how I always picture it. You are the man. You are the man. And David is contrite. And now Nathan tells him, this is why I'm here. I'm not here to tell you about this story of a rich man and some poor guy. This isn't about somebody in your kingdom who has a problem with sheep. This is about you. And so David then, because he is a good king, because he is a godly person, because he is spoken of as a man after God's own heart, he responds how? He responds with one line, which is, I have sinned. Now let's talk for a moment, okay, about the wider setting for 2 Samuel 11. 2 Samuel 11 is the fulcrum on which this is where the story is found, it's the fulcrum on which David's life pivots. The repercussions of this action will be the topic of almost the entire rest of David's recorded life in the Bible. The next 7 chapters after that are dealing with the ramifications of this problem. And they are horrible. You have to put yourself into his shoes to understand what is really going on. Nathan's judgment, by the way, on him is found in 2 Samuel 12, 10 through 12. 2 Samuel 12, 10 through 12. Nathan tells him, now therefore, the sword shall never depart from your house. And indeed it does not, by the way, it does not. Because you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife, thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up evil against you out of your own house. I will take your wives before your eyes and give them to your neighbor. He shall lie with your wives in the sight of this son. For you did it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel and before the sun. And neighbor is an interesting term for Nathan to use here because it's not neighbor. He doesn't tell him it's actually going to be one of your own sons. It's going to be one of your own sons that does this to you in the sight of all Israel. And it will be done in the sight of all Israel. Why? Not because it's a private, lust-oriented situation, but because it's a coup. And so The very next chapter, by the way, starts this. There's no delay within the Bible to this judgment coming on. I don't know how long this separation was between 12 and 13, but we immediately start down the track with Amnon and Tamar, all right? And so Amnon is who? He's a son of David. And Tamar is who? She's a daughter of David. She's there by different mothers, but same father. And so Amnon ends up raping Tamar. And Amnon and Tamar's brother is who? Well, it's Absalom. And Absalom gets upset and he kills Amnon for it, all right? And then at one point in the story, David thinks every one of his sons has been killed, but, you know, one of his sleazy nephews or uncles basically says, no, it's not all your kids. It's only Amnon. Absalom's been planning this for a long time. And so Absalom has this in-again, out-again relationship with his dad, doesn't he? But he eventually stages a coup to take over the whole country. And then Ahithophel, who's the counselor, the much-valued counselor of David, basically Absalom says, what am I going to do about this? What's the best way to show I've taken over the kingdom? And then Ahithophel says, well, I think you should take all the concubines that got left here and sleep with them on the roof. Remind you, this is the same roof, right? The roof features prominently twice in this story, once in the beginning and once in this middle section. And so sure enough, Absalom does this. Now, Absalom eventually gets killed by Joab later on, which causes David huge amounts of grief, because even though this has happened to him, it's still his son. And so the rest of David's life is drenched in blood and sadness. There is no other way to put it. We can read about this in the Bible and we can kind of make it clinical. But if you put yourself into those shoes, if I imagine that, you know, my nephews, I have three nephews and two nieces. If I imagine one of them raped the other one and then one of the other ones killed the other one, what a nightmare that would be. Instead of a baptism I'm telling you about this evening, I'm talking about murder and rape within the same family. What a nightmare. And this is the entire rest of David's life. And then it goes into Shimei. There's other people that rebel against him. He truly is exactly as God says. The sword does not depart from his house for the remainder of his days. He suffers for this. In many ways, I wonder how often David thought to himself, maybe I would have been better off dying when that judgment hit. Because the judgment for any Israelite doing something like that would have been death. Instead, of course, when David says to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. It says, and Nathan said to David, the Lord also has put away your sin. You shall not die. The immediate response of Nathan is to know that God has already put away David's sin. He's already eliminated his sin. But this final judgment comes after the first part. And Nathan tells him, nevertheless, because by this deed you have utterly scorned the Lord, the child who is born to you shall die. That's verse 14 of 2 Samuel 12. The very next verse, 2 Samuel 12, 15 says, and the Lord afflicted the child that Uriah's wife bore to David, and he became sick. I sometimes wonder if these passages were written the way they were because people wondered if David got away with murder and got away with adultery. And the fact that the rest of his life is a gigantic, stinking mess makes you realize that no, he did not. And God carries out judgment in ways that no parent would really want to ever see. I would rather die than find out that my kids had done all this horrible stuff and watch them die in front of me, watch one of them kill another one. If you were to be told as a parent, which would you rather have? Next week you can die, or for the rest of your life you can watch your kids rape and murder each other. I think a lot of us here would say, I'll take the former option and not the latter. And so, but David doesn't get that put in front of him. No, he is kind of forced to live through this and watch the mess unfold. And so immediately the Lord afflicted the child that Uriah's wife bore to David, and he became sick. Now, what does David do in reaction to this? What is his response? Here we kind of begin the meat of the lesson this evening. Is that David has a relationship with God that is amazing. Now, each one of the four people we're going to talk about is like that. They each have an incredible relationship, which in many ways is unique to each of them, which is why I like this sermon series too so much. Moses, from this morning that Justin talked about, of course, remember that when they rebelled against Moses, that God says to the assembly, you know, I got prophets around here. who I talk with in dreams, you know. But I don't talk that way to Moses. I chat with Moses like a friend to a friend. And we see that, of course, in the phrase that I both love and is, I mean, the way he said it, and then Justin read it this morning, when he says, no, and stop asking. Stop asking me. We are not going to talk about this again. And that's like two friends that are, you know, one is angry with the other one. No, we're not going to talk about this anymore. It's like conversational. Now, David has his own incredible relationship with God, does he not? And so David says, I'm going to go approach God and ask him anyway for the life of my son. Even though he's been told the life of your son is forfeit because you did this thing, I'm going to take this child. And David's like, well, okay, but I'm going to pray to you about it. And he throws everything into it. He throws absolutely his entire existence into this. David therefore sought God on behalf of the child, and David fasted and went in and lay all night on the ground. And the elders of his house stood beside him to raise him from the ground, but he would not, nor did he eat food with them. Now, a few verses later, we're going to find out that basically he stays on the ground and he doesn't eat for 7 days. Okay, he doesn't just lay there for one night like this one verse seems to say. He lays there for a week and tears his clothes, probably in classic Jewish style, and he fasts. And it's so much so that the same advisors, the same ones who brought in Bathsheba, they're worried about him. They're scared. They try to get him up. They try to say, eat something, king. And he doesn't. I think one of the primary lessons that we learn is from David here in this passage is about the very nature of God. God is not, and understand this, when I say this, you're going to agree with me because you know it, but we know it, but we don't live it always. God is not a computer, all right? He's not a machine. He's a person. Now, I don't mean he's a human. Don't misunderstand me there. But he is a personality. He has a mind of his own, and he does what he wants to do, okay? And you really see that a lot in Moses' interaction with him because the two chat and they reason. God says, out of the way, Moses. I'm going to annihilate these people. And Moses says, please don't, God. They go back and forth. God has a mind. He is not a computer. And unfortunately, we can treat him that way. We can say, how do we manipulate him in such a way that he will say yes to our prayers instead of no? And if we get a no, it must mean what? That we just didn't manipulate him correctly. As much as I adore the book of James, and indeed I do, we can fall into a trap with the passage that says what? Where James says, you need to go to God to ask for these things, and the reason why you're getting told no is because you asked for the wrong reasons. Now, James doesn't say that so that we can think to ourselves, awesome, if I can have my reasons right, he's a big computer, he'll always spit out cash for me. He'll always give me what I want. No, that's wrong. That's absolutely incorrect. God is still a personality. He's a mind. He has his own opinions and his own thoughts. And David goes to him in that way. David goes to plead with God, not to try to manipulate God. We might wonder, is he trying to manipulate God with this fasting, with his penance? Does he have that going on? And I don't think he is at all. And in fact, that's going to become much clearer later on. So let's talk about, though, what kind of man is pleading with God here? Because we might have wondered to ourselves, you know, maybe God says no because David's not especially good at praying. That should strike us as absurd. 73 of the Psalms are attributed to David, and many of these are prayers. I think that of the four guys we have to look at, we have the most prayers recorded from David himself. That's not to say that he prayed more than Jesus did. I'm definitely not saying that. But we don't have those all-night prayers from Jesus recorded in the text, or the Bible would be a lot longer. No, a lot of his prayers are recorded in the Psalms. Imagine your prayer life being such that God takes the prayers that you said to him and has them inspired by the Spirit to be placed into the Bible for all of time. Isn't that an amazing thing? And many of his prayers are extremely passionate. Over and over again, we find wording, right? Psalm 17, 1 through 2. Hear a just cause, O Lord. Attend to my cry. Give ear to my prayer from lips free of deceit. From your presence, let my vindication come. Let your eyes behold the right. Psalms 28, 1 through 2. To you, O Lord, I call. My rock, be not deaf to me. Lest if you be silent to me, I become like those who go down to the pit. Hear the voice of my pleas for mercy when I cry to you for help, when I lift up my hands towards your most holy sanctuary. Over and over again in the Psalms, we have a picture of David as a person who's deeply worried, maybe even insecure about a lot of his life. He gets scared about the situations he's in. How can he not be? Saul spends a big chunk of energy and effort trying to kill him over and over again. And then he gets his, you know, after he does this, his kids rise up, and he goes into battle after battle after battle, and each one he must have kind of wondered, is this it for me? Am I going to live through this, or does God have other plans? Does he have other plans? One of the interesting things about this part, as opposed to Moses this morning, is that David doesn't receive a no directly. He doesn't get told no and stop asking. He's a little bit more like us. We don't know when the no comes, do we? We don't really know when it's there unless it gets answered in a hard way, as in we prayed for this person to live and they didn't. Then we know the no has happened. But imagine you pray for something that makes the no more difficult to see. Then it's harder, isn't it? Have you ever prayed for somebody that has fallen away from the church and you do it over and over again? You don't know that they're going to come back, and you don't know when you should stop. Do you stop? I mean, God doesn't tell you stop asking, right? Maybe it'd be kind of nice if he did. No, I'm not going to save that person. Stop asking me. Do you just go on for 20 years and keep doing it? David at least finally gets a no because he's praying for something that has an end here. And of course, the most famous of the Psalms, right? Written after the events of 2 Samuel 11. Have mercy on me, O God, according to your steadfast love. According to your abundant mercy, blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity. Cleanse me from my sin. For I know my transgressions and my sin is ever before me. Against you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight, so that you may be justified in your words and blameless in your judgment. Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me. Behold, you delight in truth in the inward being, and you teach me wisdom in the secret heart. Purge me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Wash me, and I shall be whiter than snow. Let me hear joy and gladness. Let the bones that you've broken rejoice. Hide your face from my sins and blot out all my iniquities. Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a right spirit within me. Cast me not away from your presence. Take not your Holy Spirit from me. Restore to me the joy of your salvation. Uphold me with a willing spirit. Then I will teach transgressors your ways, and sinners will return to you. Deliver me from blood guiltiness, O God of my salvation, and my tongue will sing aloud of your righteousness. O Lord, open my lips, and my mouth will declare your praise. For you will not delight in sacrifice, or I would give it. You will not be pleased with the burnt offering. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart. O God, you will not despise. Do good to Zion in your good pleasure. Build up the walls of Jerusalem. Then you will delight in right sacrifices and burnt offerings and whole burnt offerings. Then bulls will be offered on your altar. But all of this is to no avail, isn't it? Because it says in 2 Samuel 12:18, on the seventh day, the child died. On the seventh day, the child died. Now his servants are scared. And the servants of David were afraid to tell him the child was dead. For they said, behold, while the child was yet alive, we spoke to him. He did not listen to us. How then can we say to him, the child is dead? He made to himself some harm. David's a passionate man. He's known to be a passionate man throughout the entirety of the Bible. This is the guy who danced in front of the Ark of the Covenant when it came home. This is the guy who wrote those Psalms I just read, and over again, more and more of them. This is the guy who weeps. This guy who throws himself on the ground, who fasts for 7 days. They can't get him up. Now, he worries, they say to themselves, about his son. He's going to kill himself or harm himself in some way because of the death of his son. And they're whispering in the hallways, don't tell him. Don't tell him. At this point, as the Bible often does, we're shifted into the narrative directly. We see ourselves in the hallways with the servants. The 7 days are written of as 7 days, right? He fasts, he lays there 7 days. But this part is a conversation. In 2 Samuel 12:20, it says, Oh no, 2 Samuel 12:19, it says, but when David saw that his servants were whispering together, now we're in the hallways with them, and so you're right there. I just love the way the Bible does this. Boom, you're right in the narrative. The rest of it's outside time-wise, and then you're right there in the conversation, and he sees them. He looks at them, and presumably he's still laying there on the ground, and they're whispering somehow, and he says, is the child dead? And they don't lie to him. Yes, he's dead. They must be scared to death. What is he going to do? It says, then David arose from the earth, washed and anointed himself, changed his clothes, and he went into the house of the Lord and worshipped. He then went to his own house, and when he asked, they set food before him and he ate. Okay. Now when we read this, it's tough to put ourselves into the shoes of David. It's tough for us to be in there with him. The Bible's trying to get you in there with him, but it's really hard. But imagine that you'd prayed for 7 days and you fasted for 7 days, so you're weak. You haven't had any food. You've been laying on the floor for 7 days, and you've been worried about your son, and your son dies? What now? And what does David do? He gets himself up, washes himself. Confusion. We should be confused by this. You know, usually now, because we've heard the story so many times, we're like, yeah, he does this, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, that's because we're not in the story. In the story, his own counselors are completely flabbergasted by this attitude. Why would you pray for your son to live, and when your son dies, you just decide, let's be honest here. What does David look like? You know, we have to say these words. He looks like flippant about the whole thing. He looks like, meh, I don't care about that kid anyway. All right, wash myself off. Go have some food, you know, get on with life, move on. It's all about move on now, you know. I'm going to suggest to you that if you read it on his face, that's what it looks like. And I'm also going to suggest to you that that's what his counselors were thinking. Like, what are you doing? Normally, when you have a death, the person dies, and then you mourn even more than before the death, right? But you've inverted this. Why have you done this? And they ask him, right, what is this thing you have done? You fasted and wept for the child while he was alive, but when the child died, you arose and ate food? What Israelite does this? This is a nation of people who, when somebody dies, you fast for like, you know, a month afterwards or whatever, right? I mean, you had all these rules of funerary circumstances, and a lot of it was to wear sackcloth and ashes around for a long time. And he doesn't do that. He completely inverts what's going on here. So what is his response when they ask him this? He said, now listen to this, and listen to the words that he says. I'm going to read it in a way that I think his counselors might have almost heard him say it, all right? He said, while the child was still alive, I fasted and wept, for I said, who knows whether the Lord will be gracious to me, that the child may live. But now he's dead. Why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him, but he will not return to me. Why did he fast and weep while the child was still alive? He fasted and wept because the child was still alive, because he was reasoning with God as person to person, as human to human. Or, I'm sorry, not as human to personal God, as a personality, not as a computer. He was not trying to manipulate God, but he was reasoning with God. God had told him through Nathan that the child would die. I'll remind you, nevertheless, because by this deed you have utterly scorned the Lord, the child who was born to you shall die. Now, the first reaction of an ancient might have been to say, you've received a prophecy that says this child's going to die. You don't stand up against prophecies. You do what the God asks you to do. But that's not what David does, because he understands that his God is different. His God is the type of God that you can reason with, that you can talk to, that you can say, like Moses said, and like David says here, well, maybe you could reconsider, God. And every so often, historically, God's does reconsider. He says, I'm going to do this thing. And then the people reason, and he says, okay. And that's one of the great concepts of prayer in the Old Testament. We're not going to talk about Hezekiah. Hezekiah is not a no. Hezekiah goes and he gets told by Isaiah, put your stuff in order, you're going to die. And he prays to God. And before Isaiah is even out, he gets told, go back and tell him he's not going to die. Right? God reconsiders. Now, an ancient's idea of God was that God was like a computer. If the computer said no, you didn't argue with the computer. The computer said no. If the computer said yes, it was good. You didn't argue with the yes. It was all great. You got one thing or the other. You manipulated God. You played with God. You fed God so that you got what you wanted out of God. You did certain sacrifices to God. You prayed because you were trying to manipulate God. And the God of the Bible is not that kind of God. Now, I've gone too far almost here, and I apologize. I had too much to cover here in a way, but I want us to focus in here on what he says in this closing time for this lesson. David said, "While the child was still alive, I fasted and wept. For I said," now look at the wording here. Like I said, this is the wording that seems almost flippant. "Who knows whether the Lord will be gracious to me that the child may live?" That almost sounds like, who knows? Well, I don't know. Let's ask anyway, right? Let's just go ask him just to see what happens. I don't think that's David's mindset here. I think David's saying, nobody knows if the child's going to live or die. God told me that he was going to die, but he's still alive. And while the child is still alive, I don't know the answer to that prayer. I don't know that I've got to know yet. So I'm going to try my best and see if God will let me reason with him. See if God will let me plead with him. This is widely considered to be one of the main places in the Old Testament where we can find the concept of a resurrection, isn't it? You know, Jesus, when he talks to the Sadducees, doesn't use this passage, but the Sadducees and the Pharisees had this main disagreement over the concept of the resurrection. It's the reason why the Sadducees challenged Jesus with the concept of resurrection. And Jesus goes to the Pentateuch. He goes specifically to, God says, "I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He's not the God of the dead, but of the living." Okay? And one of the reasons why he does that and not to other passages is because the Sadducees had decided that the main books of the Bible that mattered were the first five. But one of the most powerful arguments for some concept of the resurrection is this passage here. In fact, if we can only really understand David's response in two ways. We can either look at him as being flippant here and trivializing something which he is not that kind of person. It is not in his character to be that way. Or we can understand that he did this for another reason. And I would submit to you that David did this because he had a profoundly powerful faith. He had an incredibly strong faith in God. He knew that what he would ask for would either be granted or not. He had an understanding of God as real. God as real, and not just God as real, but God as I said before, person. Not God as Baal, not God as one of these idols, but God as all-powerful and God as real. We here in this town ought to understand, of course, that tragedy can strike at any time, right? I bought one of the shirts, by the way, that says magnitude 7.1. I had to go get it at the Matarengo Museum, right? You know, as a way to... I just don't want a shirt that says anything higher than that on it, right? And so... I went out riding that morning on the 4th of July, a month ago, right? And it was a beautiful day. I got up when it was still cold. Not cold, it was cool. And I did a nice ride, and I broke the rear gear shifter cable on my bike. And I thought, that stinks. Oh, maybe later on, I don't know if Frisbee's is open. I might try to do something with it. I went home, and that was that. I haven't thought about it until yesterday. Because something else happened, right? We understand that tragedy can strike at any time. But I don't know how to deal with tragedy and its randomness unless I believe that there's something else to live for. Something beyond this. Maybe that's because I'm weak. I know that there's atheists online that would scoff at me for that. So maybe I'm confessing something that some weak-minded Christian believes, but I don't know how you deal with the possibility of an 8 or a 9 randomly at any moment, at any time of day, with crazy conspiracy theorists telling us it's because of what the base is doing. I don't know how you deal with this thing that sits over you without something outside of us, without a faith in an afterlife, a faith in something beyond this world, a faith in a better place. I think that's what David had. And I think that's the reason why his response is like it is. I think that's why he says, he can't come back to me, but I can go to him. We can argue that the Hebrew there can be working for a Sheol or whatever. I don't think it is. I think David had a belief in the afterlife. And I think he thought to himself, I'm going to go see my kids someday. And you know what? I have to believe that about the people that have gone on before me now, or I have a really hard time living in this life. It is very difficult. And I think that if we were stronger and had a better faith, then we can handle the no's in a better way. I think that the people of the Bible, they handle the no's the way they do because of their powerful faith. I think that Moses does not get angry at God and lose his faith because of his faith. He handles the no the way he does because of his faith. And I think David handles the no the way he does because of his faith. And I think we're going to see the same thing with Paul and with Jesus. And I don't know how you can live a life today if you aren't a believer and if you aren't a member of the church. I don't know how you can live a life today and not believe in something beyond this one. As Justin said this morning, more eloquently than I am, he said, there's one path that we're given in the Bible. There's one way that we're shown to get right with God, to have our sins forgiven, to be on the right side, to have a hope for a future that's not a zero, that's not either bad or nothing, right? That's kind of your options, bad or nothing, or do what he said and good, right? So we have a well laid out set of requirements here. We have a well laid out set of understanding, not complex things, not complicated, not difficult. But in Romans 6, like Justin said, and like he read this morning, that it talks about baptism being a part of what gets us into the blood of Christ. It's what puts us into that death that we want to be a part of so that we can be a part of what? A part of the life of Christ. If you're here this evening and you haven't been baptized into his death, you aren't living into his life, how do you handle tragedies like we face? How will you handle it when someone dies that's close to you? Are you just going to console yourself with, you know, a better diet and hope that that doesn't happen next time to somebody else? Are you going to think to yourself that you won't die because you prevented it somehow? Will you think to yourself, if somebody is just healthy, then they'll live forever? These are nonsense things. How are you really going to handle it? If you're here this evening and you don't belong to him, if you have any need at all, if you need to repent and come to him, then would you do it now as we stand to sing the song that's been selected?